Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, the director of UNAIDS meets with Pope Benedict and other top Vatican officials to promote closer collaboration on combating the HIV virus. And I'll be talking to the founder and director of the George Washington Institute for Spirituality and Health, seeking to promote a more compassionate face for healthcare in the US. Though Pope Benedict has been taking a well-earned break in Castel Gandolfo following the Holy Week and Easter liturgies, he was back in Rome on Wednesday for his weekly general audience. Among the thousands of pilgrims attending that audience in St. Peter's Square was a rather high-profile visitor, Dr. Michel Sidibe, Executive Director of UNAIDS, the United Nations body charged with coordinating a global response to the HIV/AIDS pandemic. Last year, Dr. Sidibe was a guest speaker at a Rome conference on AIDS prevention and care, sponsored by the Pontifical Council for Healthcare Workers, urging closer cooperation between faith communities and organisations like his own. After a brief meeting with Pope Benedict at the end of the audience and talks with other top Vatican officials, Dr. Sidibe spoke to me about the purpose of his visit and about a current campaign to eliminate mother-to-child transmission of the HIV virus. Dr. Michel Sidibe, I'd like to ask you first of all about the reasons for your visit here to the Vatican and in particular about your meeting with Pope Benedict.
You know, my visit is a very simple one. I am convinced that we will never change the face of people who are suffering from HIV if we are not fostering the link between science, religions, and social change. And for me, the Church is playing a critical role to help us to reach those people who are in the grassroots levels through their mechanism. Every Sunday, they have families coming. So we need to use this strength to help us to fight stigma, discrimination, but also helping us to inform people that being sexually responsible is important when you want really to prevent new infections.
Can you give us some examples, perhaps, of places where you've seen these policies in action, where the Church really has made a difference?
You know, in Lesotho, where you have 40% of services which are given to vulnerable people, given by a Church, a faith-based organization, I saw there a young woman who has been affected by this HIV, and she was pregnant, and she was HIV positive. But because she managed to be transparent and reach the hospital managed by a faith-based organization, she got medicine, and the baby was born HIV negative. So for me, those are individual cases, but cases which matter, showing that you can save a mother, you can at the same time avoid a baby to be born HIV negative, and also give chance to that child to grow without being an orphan. And for me, that is important.
This elimination of mother-to-child transmission is one of your goals, isn't it, by 2015. Are you on track to do that, do you think?
Yes, I think we are on track. A few years ago, no one was even believing that we could even talk about virtual elimination of transmission from mother to child. Today, we have a big global plan, which has been launched during the high-level meetings just a few months ago. But today, we have 22 countries who have been able to review their strategy to establish a new programs. And those 22 countries, of course, are countries with 90% of a new infection every year. So now that they are mobilized and they can really be able to move this agenda, it will help us to change. It is important for us. Why? Because it's important because it is something we can really deliver on. It is not costly. We are talking about $150 to just stop the transmission. You could imagine It is return on investment, because with that one, we could avoid a baby to be born with HIV. And if this baby is born with HIV, it will cost us more than $150,000. So why to not do that in 2012?
One of the reasons why is still stigma, isn't it? Discrimination, because it depends on women being able to come forward and come for testing and come for treatment.
You're right. Stigma, discrimination. It's also the lack of engagement of men. It is also the fact that most of those women are not knowledgeable. They don't have information. They are living in situation where they have been generally taken hostage by their social status. They are poor women. So that's why we think it's important to really give chance to that woman to have access to information so she can protect herself. And she can be able to avoid first HIV/AIDS. But if she is HIV positive, at least she can have access to care and treatment to help her to have a baby free of HIV. And that's why I was here. And I was very lucky to really meet with His Holiness today. And my only message was, we don't need a baby born with HIV. And for me, I know His Holiness, His commitment for destitute, for people without voice. But I know also that a call from Him to the leaders of this world to say that it's not acceptable to have more than 900,000 babies with HIV every year in Africa when it's not happening in the rest of the world. I think this call to say is not acceptable. It is issues of social justice. It is issues of better redistributing our opportunities to stop that will help a lot.
What would you like to see the church doing in more concrete terms to try and help, as you say, stop these babies being born with AIDS?
I think the church could help us in many ways. First, to really advocate and mobilize those families, to equip them with proper information, to make them understanding that testing is possible. And then when they are tested positive, they can have access to treatment. And also making sure that people don't stigmatize those women. People understand that it could happen to be HIV positive. But today, being HIV positive is not a death sentence. It's possible to live with HIV. So those messages the church can help us with. But more than that one, the church, through, I think, the pastoral letters, letters which can be really sent to all the church, to all the congregation, by telling them to say to the Sunday morning that we can stop the transmission from mother to child, go for testing, and make sure that when you're positive, don't be scared. Drugs is available. Make sure that you contact the health centers to have access to those medicine to protect you. And also, we are working with Caritas in different parts of the world. They are in most of the countries today with a different type of programs. It's important to equip them and to help them to have also a possibility to reach with people with the services which can protect them, particularly treatment and information which can help them to be safe.
We used to think of sub-Saharan Africa and perhaps Southeast Asia as the two critical areas where infections kept rising, and yet now in many of these countries, infections are decreasing. The areas, if I understand correctly, that you're concerned about now are the Middle East and Eastern Europe. Why is this? Why are you not being able to make progress there?
I think you're right. Just a few years ago, people were saying that the epicenter of the crisis was Africa. We were having only two countries with a successful program, Uganda and Senegal. Today, we have worldwide almost 56 countries who managed to stabilize, even to reduce significantly the number of new infections. But we still have, unfortunately, an increase of new infection, 250% increase in the last 10 years on new infection in Eastern Europe and Central Asia. It's simple, because I personally feel that people who need services, particularly who need to be protected to have access to health care, people who inject drugs don't have. They are considered as criminal, so they hide themselves, and they infect the other people. So we are not promoting drug use. I'm not promoting homosexualities. I'm not promoting sex work. But I am promoting the protection of vulnerable people. When you're vulnerable, we need compassion. We need to make sure that those groups are access to services. When I'm talking about services, I'm talking about care, I'm talking about treatment. And that is the same problem in the Middle East today and generally in the northern part of Africa. I just came from Algeria and Morocco, and I can tell you that it was the same message. It is the second areas of the fastest infection in the world today, and we need to pay attention to stigma, discrimination, and we need to make sure that people who are vulnerable are having access to treatment and care and support.
My thanks there to the Executive Director of UNAIDS, Dr. Michelle Sidibe. The George Washington Institute for Spirituality and Health was set up in 2001 with an ambitious goal: to change the face of the healthcare system in the United States by promoting a more compassionate and integrated type of care. Through education and innovative programs, publications and conferences, it's done just that and has had a major impact on hospitals and healthcare professionals across the US and beyond. At the heart of its mission is the belief that spirituality, understood in its broadest sense, has a profound effect on our health and well-being, as well as helping us to deal with sickness, suffering and death. The founder and director of the Institute, Dr. Christina Puchalski, came to our studios with Monsignor Bob Vitillo, Special Advisor on HIV/AIDS to the Caritas Confederation. Christina, tell me about this George Washington Institute. It was founded over a decade ago.
But the work for it started over 20 years ago. And it started with a course I developed at George Washington University on spirituality and health. And the impetus for that was some work that I did at NIHS when I was a researcher, and noticing how people who were coming to the National Institutes for Health for treatment because conventional treatment had failed, and while they were thought of as sort of end-stage hopeless cases, in my experience with them, they had tremendous amount of resources from spirituality, faith, that impacted and their lives. And I felt that that was important for clinicians to recognize.
So the aim was to develop this area of work and spread.
Exactly. And around that time, there were others who were beginning to do some research on the role of religion, spirituality, and health. My focus initially was developing courses so the doctors would learn how to address spiritual issues with patients. And then over the years, we had the first course was in 1992, and now we have about 75% of medical schools in the United States that have topics related to spirituality and health integrated in their curricula.
So it's been hugely successful, in fact.
I think so, yeah. And we actually have a textbook, the first textbook in spirituality and health coming out, which is edited by Mark Cobb, who is in the United Kingdom. He's in England. Myself from the U.S. and Bruce Rumbold from Australia. And we have contributors from all over the world. And this will be coming out with Oxford University Press in the spring of this year.
I imagine there must be critics, though, people who say that this really question of faith and spirituality has nothing to do with, quote, serious medicine.
Yes, that's true. There are critics, though. It's changing, but there are critics, and some of the concerns may be even valid. And the concerns are, is it appropriate for doctors and nurses to talk about spirituality with their patients? Shouldn't this just be left in the realm of the chaplains, for example? Or there's a concern about proselytizing. But I think one of our aims at the George Washington Institute for Spirituality and Health is to make this accessible to all people so that issues of meaning and purpose and how people cope with suffering and their understanding of their illness outside of themselves in a broader philosophical context transcends religion and transcends cultures, really about meaning and purpose. One of our definitions that we developed by consensus in a consensus conference was that spirituality has to do with how people find meaning and purpose in their life and how they express it, but also their connection with the other. And that other may be sacred or significant. It may be God. It may be people. It may be community. It may be nature. It may be the arts. So in fact, the critics, once they understand that definition, realize that it is something at a broader level that is relevant to people's lives. And we have ethical standards. You know, it's inappropriate for doctors and nurses to do what chaplains do because we're not, in fact, trained as chaplains and clergy. And it's also inappropriate to proselytize. Respect and dignity of the other person is paramount in this work.
How does this work at a very practical level? Mm-hmm. How do you go about beginning to engage with a patient at this level of faith and spirituality?
Right. So we developed a tool called FICA, a spiritual history tool. And physicians and other clinicians who develop treatment plans generally do a history, a clinical history. And in that history, we ask about why you're here. What is your past medical history? What is your social history? We call the patient-centered or person-centered part of the interview. And that's where we ask about relationships and work, avocations, and that's where we've put in the spiritual history. And so the tool is simply, do you have spiritual beliefs or practices that are important in your life? What gives your life meaning? And then looking at how is that important and what influence, the I part of that, what influence does that have in the way that you understand health and illness and make healthcare decisions. So it's very much law. It's not just out there, but it's lodged and related to what the person is going through. So obviously, if someone is dying, how is this in your life now that you're dying? If it's a well visit, how does your spirituality impact your understanding of health? So it's across all terms. And then C is community, which could be church, temple, mosque, but might be like-minded friends. And then A is how should that be addressed in your care? Now that we've developed models, we actually propose, and this is a bit controversial, but you know, we propose that clinicians think about a rule-out diagnosis, that if I think there's spiritual distress in the patient, I'm going to look at what is that distress? Is it despair? Is it hopelessness? Is it isolation from their faith community or other spiritual community? But I wouldn't be the one finalizing that diagnosis. I would identify that, so that's the A part. In my plan, in my treatment plan, I would then suggest a referral to a board-certified chaplain. So the whole notion of what we call a biopsychosocial spiritual treatment assessment and treatment plan is very novel. So that we're not only looking at the physical aspects of the patient, but also at the psychosocial and spiritual aspects of the patient.
Now, as you rightly say, you're working closely, I imagine, with ministers of religion from all the different religions, not just chaplains, as you say, or people from the Catholic or Christian backgrounds.
So let's talk about that, because board-certified chaplains are not just Catholic. Chaplains come from all different religious traditions. Imams from the Muslim tradition, there are board-certified imams who are chaplains. And chaplains are a little bit different than clergy. Certainly in the Catholic tradition in the U.S., most of the chaplains are women. So that's a broader term. So yes, we work with chaplains who in turn are trained to work with people of all faiths or not. They work with atheists and agnostics as well and people who are secular. But yes, we also work with clergy and clergy of all different denominations. Absolutely.
Father Bob Vitillo, how does this work relate to the whole area that you're interested in? You're working with Caritas on a very broad spectrum of health issues, particularly the focus on HIV/AIDS.
A number of ways. Certainly through the experience of HIV and AIDS, I think that many clinicians came to understand the need to pay attention to spirituality in reaching out to people with HIV. They were dealing with, until very recently, a deadly illness. Now it's with medication. medication. It could be a chronic illness, but also there were deep emotional and social issues around HIV. And many people who began to live with HIV had been alienated from their faith communities and even from their local communities and families. Yet they turned to spirituality to deal with the deeper meaning of this. So I think that was a good lesson that went beyond just HIV care, but to medical and social care in general. Then the other part of my interest is that because I do a great deal of advocacy at the United Nations and especially with the World Health Organization, in 1997, the World Health Assembly agreed that the spiritual dimension should be included in WHO's definition of health, good health. And yet the Secretariat at WHO never took that action any further. So when I began to speak with Dr. Puchalski, I thought this is a good opportunity now for us to promote the inclusion of the spiritual dimension in health.
Within the Catholic Church, of course, healthcare plays a vital role. And yet there's often, if you like, a reluctance within the Catholic Church to work closely with what are sometimes seen as cutting-edge scientific or medical advances. Is this an area, do you think, where there can be much closer understanding and much closer cooperation?
Well, I think there is close collaboration, but the Catholic Church also says we have to have certain ethical guidelines and we need to follow those ethics so that we don't go beyond respect for the dignity of the human person and respect for life from conception to natural death. But other than that, I think there is very close collaboration. And I think too many times there's a kind of false and mistaken dichotomy that's set up between spirituality and science. And the Holy Father, Pope Benedict XVI, has talked about this many times, that that is not a dichotomy that needs to be made, that we need to respect the discovery of science, but also the more we discover in science, the more we know that there's also a creator that goes far beyond what we can learn within science. So we need both. Too many times religious leaders tell people of faith that they should not have faith in modern science or modern medicine, and they should just pray for a healing. Well, there are. Certainly, there's good evidence that healing could happen through prayer, but we also need to use the best of the medicine and the science as well.
You're looking ahead, aren't you, to 2013, planning an international conference. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Sure. But may I also tell a patient story, because I think it really describes what we were just talking about. And it just happened to me this past week. I have a patient who's dying. She's in her 90s. And I got a text message, actually very modern, from the hospice nurse that time could be close. And I called the family the other night from here, actually. And part of the whole struggle that the family had is a very religious family. And they believed that by prayer, she would be cured. And clearly that wasn't happening. And so part of last week I had recommended that a chaplain come and see them. And my previous conversation last week was, Doctor, we don't want to hear this. Do not tell us that she's dying, because we are people of faith, and people of faith conquer dying. And so I thought this was not an appropriate, I could not talk anymore on that. It would not be appropriate for me as the physician to start meddling in their beliefs, particularly in this delicate time. So I suggested the hospice chaplain come. So yesterday I had the second conversation, and the chaplain visit meant so much to them. That visit with the chaplain helped them come to terms with their faith, reframing perhaps, I think, their concept of cure, and that even within dying, healing can occur. And they said, Doctor, we understand what's happening now. And they put the phone to my patient's ear so that I could say goodbye to her. And it was a very moving conversation, and I think shows the importance of these partnerships. I could not have had that kind of a conversation with them were not for the chaplain who had spent that time. And those are the realities of what happens in the field. This isn't just theoretical. And so our conference is built upon those kinds of stories. And I'm, in addition to being an internist, I'm a palliative care doctor within the palliative care field. And again, broadly defined, not just hospice, but moving early from the time of diagnosis. In the United States, there were required domains in spiritual, religious and existential concerns became a required domain about 5 years ago. So my colleague, Dr. Betty Farrell, who's a nurse, and I hosted a conference building upon that to say, okay, this is required, but who now does what? And we developed these guidelines, which were published in the Journal of Palliative Medicine, about an interdisciplinary approach where everybody on the team has that responsibility to address spiritual issues. And we talked about a screening, which would be done by a nurse or a social worker as the patient comes into a clinical setting, a history, which I've already described, and then the spiritual assessment, which is the fuller assessment that's done only by board-certified chaplains. But then how we would work with all of us on the team, including the clergy, would be other members that would enter into this in developing a treatment plan and who would carry out that in terms of spiritual treatment, if you will, a bit reductionistic, but that's how we can bring this. We need to work within the medical model. Well, these guidelines also included the transformation that occurs between the clinician and the patient, between the chaplain and clergy and the patient, and how spiritual development then is a huge piece of it, that we have to be attentive to our own spirituality as clinicians as well. So these guidelines did come to the attention of the World Health Organization, and they were very interested in perhaps not having America come in and share these guidelines, not at all, but to use that as an example of what might happen at a global level. Can we have that dialogue at a global level and find out what does this mean in practical terms for the clinicians in Africa, for the clinicians in China, for the clinicians in England, in France, in Belgium, in South America? What does it mean in Australia? What does this mean globally? Can we come up with a set of standards that will be applicable? Maybe the specifics might be slightly different, but can be applicable globally. And how might that then be used as potential policy for the World Health Organizations and other organizations to further integrate spirituality in very practical terms that yet honor each of the different denominations and honor secularism as well?
Father Bob, you've worked extensively across Africa and Asia, haven't you? Do you see this as a predominantly American model, or is it something that can work really well in developing countries?
I think the American model will be educated and informed by the approach in Africa especially, and also in Asia, because especially in Africa, health and disease have spiritual dimensions. If people are not in good relationship with the higher being, then they're sick. And also, when we're diagnosing physical illnesses in that part of the world, you need to think of the spiritual aspect. So I think that the participation of people from other continents will enrich these guidelines a great deal.
This is interesting that at a time when we talk so much about our growing secular societies, that there is this focus on spirituality in what is seen by many as a very secular area.
Well, I think from my own clinical observations and from working with colleagues around the world, that 9/11 and then the subsequent economic crisis has forced people to look inward. I think they've begun to lose faith, if you will, in materialism, as they've seen a lot of the problems with that, and have begun to look inward. And my own observation is that there's a huge rise in spirituality within both a religious and a secular context, because the whole question of, and again, people who are ill face this, what is really my value in life? You know, if I lose everything, if I lose my health, if I lose money, if I lose my home, whatever that loss is, who am I really in this? And these are profoundly spiritual questions. Religious organizations, religions offer people a language in for meaning and purpose, and a language for something that transcends the physical, that transcends the economics, that we still have inherent value and dignity even in the face of total loss, whether it's losing one's life, as in a dying process, or losing what previously gave them meaning in an economic crisis. So I think there is that global search now for something spiritual, and hence an increasing recognition in the importance of spirituality as part of life in general.
My thanks there to Dr. Christina Puchalski, director of the George Washington Institute for Spirituality and Health, and to Monsignor Bob Vitillo, special advisor on HIV/AIDS to the Caritas Confederation. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin. You're listening to Vatican Radio, Laudato Jesus Christus.